The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Case studies of electrolyte disorders is presented by Dr. Mark Baldwin.
So the first thing in evaluating a patient who has a disorder of sodium and water is urine electrolyte studies, compare the serum sodium to urine sodium, compare the serum osmolarity to the urine osmolarity, the urinary anion gap, or evaluate the patient's fluid status. So anybody have some ideas? Yeah. Every specialty has its ultimate philosophical question. In cardiology, the question is the chest pain cardiac or non-cardiac? In GI, are they bleeding upper or lower? In nephrology, is the patient wet or dry? And it's one of the things that, remember the poor man's Swan-Ganz catheter, pinching the neck. Okay, this is really an important thing, especially in somebody who has hypo or hypernatremia. It's how we classify disorders of salt and water regulation is assessing the fluid status. Okay, you're seeing a patient with a history of lung cancer with metastasis. His serum sodium is 109. He is only on MS-Contin and has been eating. However, he feels weak. He appears cachectic, has a blood pressure of 130 over 68, no evidence of volume depletion. What would your next step be? Renal ultrasound, urine sodium, urine osmolarity, serum osmolarity, or B, C, and D? Okay. Yeah, renal ultrasound, I didn't say anything about his, whether he had acute or chronic kidney injury, so not unless you want to keep your radiologist busy, there's really no call for a renal ultrasound. A urine sodium will help you with this, a urine osmolarity can help you with this, and a serum osmolarity can help you to differentiate this. What's the most likely cause that we're looking at here? Yeah, SIADH. So, and that's the appropriate answer here. You know, it wasn't dehydration because the patient was eating, he had a normal blood pressure and didn't show any signs of dehydration. Otherwise, they weren't ill other than they were, you know, feeling a little weak in that. Surreptitious use of diuretics didn't really give you anything in the stem that implicated that. When diabetes insipidus, you're certainly not going to have a sodium of 109. So the answer here is SIADH. So what's the best treatment for this? Fluid restriction, tolvaptan, 3% saline at 60 an hour for 24 hours. Hydrochlorothiazide or furosemide? Okay, let's work backwards. Furosemide, probably not. He didn't, any evidence the guy had any kind of fluid overload. Obviously, thiazide, both the thiazide and furosemide are gonna make the hyponatremia worse, especially the thiazide. 3% saline at 60 mLs an hour for 24 hours. About 5 hours later, you'll hear a large bang of his brain exploding. So that's probably not the best treatment. Tolvaptan, which it is a V2 receptor antagonist, which it sometimes is indicated. In this case, is probably not because we don't have any, you know, situation that's really pushing us toward that. So initial treatment is going to be fluid restriction. There can be a role for Vaptans down the road, but initially the first thing you're going to do is fluid restriction. Okay? Ah, we have another hyponatremia. you're seeing a patient with a serum sodium of 112. Serum osmolarity is 260 and the urine osmolarity is 280. They're not on any medications and the blood pressure is a penny's worth hypertensive. The most likely diagnosis is A, dehydration, B, sepsis, C, repetitious use of diuretics, D, syndrome of inappropriate secretion of ADH, E, diabetes insipidus. Silence is deafening. Now, if I'm saying, you guys have had some college, correct? Okay. This is a classic case, once again, of SIADH. Okay? Why is that? What is SIADH? Well, SIADH is where you have inappropriate secretion of antidiuretic hormone. Now, what the hell does antidiuretic hormone do? Well, it acts on the collecting duct to regulate the uptake of water in the collecting duct. So if you're dehydrated, you're going to have appropriate secretion of ADH to try to hold on to water so you're not dehydrated. If you have congestive heart failure where your baroreceptors and pressure receptors are being underperfused, the body thinks that it's volume depleted, you're going to have appropriate secretion of ADH. You're going to have increase in water, okay? So in those cases, it is appropriate for the clinical condition. When it's inappropriate is, for whatever reason, something is stimulating the production of antidiuretic hormone, okay? And that leads us to the Bader-Schwartz criteria for diagnosis of SIADH. This was originally described back in the 50s, and it still stands the test of time. Okay, so how do we make the diagnosis of SIADH? Well, the first thing is that you can't have any other secondary factors. You have to have normal renal function, normal cardiac function, normal liver, normal pituitary adrenal axis. If you have edema, by definition, they don't have SIADH. Okay, so all these things going on, you have hyponatremia, you have hypoosmolarity, the serum osmolarity is less than 280, you have a urine sodium greater than 20, and the urine osmolarity is greater than the serum osmolarity, and it's one of these left-handed statements we hear in clinical nephrology that dates back decades, the urine is less than maximally dilute. You have euvolemia and you have a low uric acid, okay? So let's go back to the case here. What do we have? Well, we have a low serum sodium, right? We have a serum osmolarity of 260, but the urine osmolarity is 280, okay? So the urine is holding on to a little bit more water, so that puts the urine osmolarity a little higher, okay? They're not on any medication, so the diagnosis is SIADH. Next question. A 23-year-old female collapses while doing a 100-mile bike race. She's lethargic but is able to answer questions. She complains of a progressive headache, blurred vision, nausea and vomiting, and subsequently vomits up a bunch of blue liquid consistent with what's in her water bottle. Blood pressure is 128 over 60. Heart rate's 92. Respirations are 20. Her glucose is 92. And her serum sodium is 122. Her exam is remarkable only for some lethargy and some diaphoresis, okay? What's your first treatment? 100 mLs of 3% saline, normal saline, 500 bolus and 150 an hour, 1 amp of D50, 500 of Ringer's lactate, and then 150 an hour, or none of the above. If we have any cyclists, marathon cyclists or marathon runners, this is a really relevant case. Being a cyclist myself, I came up with this. So, okay, who says none of the above? Okay, How about 500 mLs of Ringer's lactate, the IV fluid of the devil? Okay. That was a correct answer. No. 1 amp of D50. Okay. How about normal saline, 500 bolus and 150 an hour? Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? Right? See? You know, except it's wrong. Okay. And the answer is give them 100 mLs of 3% saline. Okay. What this patient has is a condition called exercise-associated hyponatremia. We never saw this before 1980. What happened in 1980? Well, Gatorade started sponsoring a bunch of events. If anyone's ever done any kind of training and read anything in the quote sports literature, which is like two notches below surgical literature, where they say that you have to drink before you're thirsty, and by the time you're thirsty, you're already severely volume depleted, and you should use a sports drink and all that. I remember thinking, like, wait, I did a nephrology fellowship. I don't remember this. This is not, you know, I don't know how this came about. Well, starting in the 80s, early 80s, Gatorade starts sponsoring all these events, okay? And you start having this syndrome of exercise-associated hyponatremia. Women get it much more commonly than men. Right, 2/3 of the cases that have been reported are in women. There's a big database from a guy out of South Africa of people who've died from this, and it's usually, in many cases, fatal because it's not treated properly. And this is caused by a rapid increase in total body water relative to the amount of total body exchangeable sodium. The primary etiological factor is the consumption of large volume of water or dilute sports drinks in excess of fluid losses, okay? So what I gave you in this history, and this is a common thing, so a cyclist goes down or a runner goes down, first thing they do is they ignore the vital signs, they ignore the fact that they're sweating. Ah, they must be fluid deprived. We have to give them fluid. And in this scenario, by giving them relatively hypertonic saline, remember, sodium in normal saline, there's 154 milliequivalents of sodium. And this patient had a sodium in the low 120s, okay? So what you're giving them with normal saline is relatively hypertonic to that. And I'll get back to the 3% in a minute. What happens is you're giving them mass quantities of this, and you have an imbalance in the brain, and a day or two later, they have central pontine myelinosis, and they die. Okay? So the treatment of this is not to give them saline unless they're actually dehydrated. Okay? So what the recommended treatment now, and this is from the second conference of exercise-associated hyponatremia, is a small correction. And the operative word here is small correction. In any patient that has a change, a neurological change due to an increase or decrease in sodium, the key element there is the rate of change. You can have two patients in the emergency room with a sodium of 110. One of them's talking to you, one of them's having a seizure. The one that's having a seizure has had a rapid drop where the brain hasn't been able to adapt. The one who's sitting there talking to you is probably a little old lady who's taken her hydrochlorothiazide and not eating very much. So over time, her sodium has gradually dropped like that, okay? So in a patient like this scenario, we give them a small amount of hypertonic saline, but again, we don't correct unless there's, first of all, evidence of hyponatremia, and they have little monitors, just like we can check a glucose, that in bike races and in marathons, emergency teams have these little things. You get a drop of blood and it can tell you what the serum sodium is, okay? So first of all, you have documentation of hyponatremia and other compelling clinical situations, such as a seizure, myoclonus, confusion, coma, or a headache. We usually recommend 100 mLs of 3% saline. See how they do. If there's any change, you can repeat that for a total of 3 doses while you're transporting them into a large medical center. At that time, then the treatment is fluid restriction. Okay? Huh?
How long would time
Run it in over a couple minutes. Wait 5 minutes to see if you have any type of improvement. If you have an improvement, stop there. If you don't, do another, but do it for a total of three. And this is a little bit of the history of how Gatorade has kind of gotten its foot into the pseudoscience. They have generated an entire whole pool of questionable data, which has never been reproduced. So, okay. 54-year-old man comes in with for a cabbage. Post-op creatinine, or pre-op creatinine was 1.2. He has a history of type 2 diabetes. Intraoperatively, he required 2 hours on bypass pump, which is a lot of time. Post-operatively, he's been hypotensive, requiring pressors. 3 days post-op, his creatinine's now 3.2. Chest x-ray and renal ultrasound are negative. His cardiac output and index are low, and his wedge is low. He's afebrile, has little urine output in the past 24 hours. What would your treatment consist of? A, fluid challenge, an attempt to raise the blood pressure and wedge. B, broad spectrum antibiotics for sepsis. C, transfuse 2 units of packed red cells. D, start dialysis. E, high doses of loop diuretics to increase the urine output. Okay, how many say A? Okay, B, antibiotics, okay. Transfuse 2 units, okay. Dialysis, anyone? Okay. How about loop diuretics? You know, a big blast. Okay. Yeah, the correct answer is A. We have to, you know, this patient is probably well on his way to ATN, but he has a lot of things pointing toward we may have a window to start some fluid resuscitation. If at one point, after we give him a couple liters, his hemoglobin is now 6, obviously then we'd consider giving him some blood. 68-year-old female is admitted for mental status change. She has a history of metastatic breast cancer and has been declining recently on exam. She's very lethargic, hypotensive, tachycardia. Her sodium is 134, bicarb is 16, and her calcium is 17. The most likely explanation for the patient's presentation is A, production of a PTH-related protein, B, production of lymphokines, C, direct bony invasion, D, production of vitamin D-like substance, or E, any of the above. Okay, toward the end of my tubular interstitial talk, I talked about the mechanisms of hypercalcemia malignancy. So any one of these could be at work. This is a classic presentation of hypercalcemia malignancy. Breast cancer, acute mental status change. She presents hypotensive, dehydrated, acute kidney injury, and a calcium of 17. So what would the first treatment be? IV saline at 30 mLs an hour, IV saline for several liters, followed by a loop diuretic, C, corticosteroids, D, calcitonin, E, dialysis. Anybody for dialysis? Okay, they're trying to starve us here, Jack. Calcitonin is the first treatment, okay. Corticosteroids, okay. IV saline at 30 an hour, okay. How about several liters followed by a loop diuretic? Yeah, we give them, this patient is dehydrated, they need fluids, okay. Remember, we're all aquatic animals. We can never get that far away from Mother Ocean, okay. So you give them a few liters of fluid to get them filled up, and then if you want to use a loop diuretics while you're using some of the other modalities like calcitonin and zoledronic acid, that's fine. Okay? In a patient with hypernatremia, regardless of the cause, which of the statements is true? Elevated glucose can increase sodium level. Elevations in potassium will almost always occur. There's always a free water deficit. All of the above or none of the above? Okay, how about none of the above? Anybody, that's it? All of the above? Okay. How about there's always a free water deficit? Yeah, this is the answer. This is, unfortunately, this goes against the rule when you take a test. If you see always or never, it's the wrong answer. Anytime you have a patient who has hypernatremia, regardless of whether they're hypovolemic, euvolemic, or hypervolemic, there's always a free water deficit. By definition, hypernatremia equals free water deficit. You're seeing a 52-year-old man with a history of bipolar disorder for which he takes lithium for a number of years. His blood pressure is normal. He's not orthostatic. His serum sodium is 152, and he drinks a considerable amount of water to compensate for frequent urination. By the way, his glucose is normal. Based on his information, your working diagnosis would be A, SIADH, B, dehydration, C, psychogenic polydipsia, D, or C, central diabetes insipidus, or E, nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. How many people say A? Okay, couldn't burn you the third time, okay? Dehydration. Can we say dehydration? Well, no, it's not dehydration. He's got normal blood pressure. Psychogenic polydipsia. Okay, commonly we see this with psychiatric illness, okay? But he doesn't, the story otherwise doesn't really fit it. Then we come to either central or nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. Anybody have any idea about central diabetes insipidus? Okay, we got a couple votes there. And how about nephrogenic DI? Yeah, this is a classic case of nephrogenic DI. The guy's on lithium. Lithium, people have been on lithium long term. One of the effects of lithium is it can induce a nephrogenic DI, which then they have considerable chronic polyuria because they're chronically thirsty. So the correct answer is E. So the next step would be measure the serum ADH level, measure the urine ADH level, saline suppression test, water deprivation test, ADAVP, or none of the above. How about an ADH or urine ADH level? Now we don't routinely check those. Saline suppression test? Okay, how about water restriction? Yeah, this is, if you look at the differentiation of diabetes insipidus, the first step is always a water restriction or water deprivation test. So the results after a water deprivation test and DDAVP showed a urine osmolarity of less than 30. Your treatment would now be A, a thiazide diuretic, B, amiloride, C, daily NSAID use, D, low sodium and low protein diet, or E, all of the above. How about a thiazide? Yeah, thiazides work, you bet. Paradoxically, that's one of the treatments. How about amiloride? Amiloride's that goofy potassium-sparing diuretic that just nephrologists love. Yeah, amiloride is actually, there have been some studies that have shown that daily amiloride use may attenuate the nephrogenic effects of lithium. How about daily non-steroidal use? Now, mind you, I'm a nephrologist. Actually, this has been shown in some studies. I've personally never done it, but if you read the academic literature, that's been shown to be a treatment for this. Low sodium and low protein diets have also. So all of the above are considered treatments for nephrogenic DI, okay? So as we know, DI has central due to trauma, edema, ischemia, removal of the pituitary or congenital, in where you simply don't have enough ADH being produced. Nephrogenic is where the kidneys lose the ability to respond. Classically, we see this with drugs, obstruction, ureteral reflux, salt wasting, chronic kidney disease. People can put out large volumes of dilute urine, up to 10 to 15 liters a day, and needless to say, they're going to have some polydipsia. This is the kind of chart they like to ask on boards, okay? So you may want to keep an eye on this if you're going to be taking a certifying exam. That, well, I'll show you a case, and they'll say, after fluid deprivation, this was the urine osmolarity, what's the diagnosis? Okay, or after giving them DDAVP, this is what happened, okay? And then, I don't have enough to put this all on one slide. Then some things on plasma, what happens with plasma osmolarity, okay? So these are some nice little pearls for what they like to ask on boards. Diabetes insipidus, the key factors we diagnose this as water deprivation, hypernatremia, hyperosmolarity, dilute urine. We treat this with ADH replacement for central DI, thiazides, amiloride, possibly NSAIDs for cardiogenic PI. So you're seeing a female with hypertension, her medications include diazide, metoprolol, lisinopril, despite her compliance, her blood pressure is 168/78. Lab is remarkable for a sodium of 148 and a potassium of 2.8. Your next diagnostic test would be a plasma renin activity, an ALDO level, glucose, ADH level, catecholamines, or CT of the adrenal. How many people say A? Okay. B. Okay. C. D. Catecholamines. Okay. E. CT of the adrenal. Okay. All right, answer, yeah, this is a classic presentation of primary hyperaldosterone. This a patient with hyperaldosterone is we have too much ALDO. Taking up sodium and we're secreting potassium and hydrogen. So they're going to have hypernatremia, hypokalemia, mild metabolic alkalosis, and they're going to have uncontrolled hypertension. So in this patient, would you expect to find edema, yes or no? Because they're taking up all this extra sodium, so you're going to have edema or not? Actually, no. This is close. They call this aldosterone escape. So in primary hyperaldosteronism, you do not have edema because as you take up the volume, your volume expanded, that perfuses the kidney, and some of the excess fluid and salt gets peed out. So we call this aldosterone escape. So if you have edema, by definition, you don't have primary hyperaldosteronism. Okay? We also diagnose this, and Jack's going to talk a little bit more in his talk on hypertension about plasma renin activity ratios. We also know Kahn syndrome, and this gives you a nice little background here. Okay, your 48-year-old patient with HIV is recently found to have miliary TB, is hypertensive, tachycardia. His exam is remarkable for diffuse tan, and he doesn't go to a tanning bed. Lab shows a sodium of 147, a potassium of 6.2, 15, anion gap of 10, bupropion are mildly elevated. He has 12% eosinophils, and lab was obtained after several liters of saline normalized. The most likely explanation of the patient's condition is type 1 distal RTA, B, acute kidney injury, C, sepsis, D, Addison's disease, or E, lab error. Who says proximal RTA? Well, no, the potassium is too high. Acute kidney injury? You may make a case for that, but the better answer is sepsis. Maybe. Obviously, if he has miliary TB, he's sick. How about Addison's disease? Yeah, this is a classic example of an added presence of an Addisonian crisis. Patient has miliary TB, so they're seeing the tuberculosis bacteria from other places using the adrenal gland because there's a very high oxygen tension. So they end up destroying their adrenal glands. They present like this, and the treatment is smacking them with IV fluid and hydrocortisone. So you see, diabetic, his lab is glucose 260, sodium 138, potassium 5.7, chloride or CO2 of 16 or 17, bupropion, creatinine or 29 and 1.7. He's chronically non-compliant. I know this is hard to imagine with meds and diet. The most likely explanation of his lab is occult alcohol abuse, dehydration, Addison's, type 4, or uncontrolled diabetes. Because we're running out of time, I'll say this is a classic look at type 4 RTA. Okay. We're seeing a patient who has CHF. He's presently treated with diuretics despite equally aggressive potassium supplements. His potassium remains low. The next step, check the serum MAG level. Okay, so in patients that have refractory hypokalemia, remember to check the magnesium level, and there's a whole bunch of things here that can cause this. Once again, PPIs are on this list. In hypomagnesemia has an effect. effect on a thing called the renal automedullary potassium channel, and I can't keep my board certification unless I show you some segment of a nephron here. Okay. Jack will show you a picture of the renin-angiotensin system, so it'll be full complement here. So what happens is, if you look at the pink slide there, calcium and magnesium act on a thing called the calcium sensing receptor. When potassium is low, the magnesium goes in and blocks that ROMK. So you're able to hold on to magnesium or hold on to potassium. If magnesium is absent, you end up peeing out all your excessive potassium. So you can hang a 55-gallon drum there, and it's not going to work unless you replace the underlying magnesium. So, okay, you're seeing a patient on the trauma service, which is the first problem. For evacuation of subdural from an accident, he's had postoperative fluids, he had significant polyuria, sodium is 154 with an osmolarity of 320. Cause of the patient's sodium abnormality is under secretion of ADH. This is a classic postoperative trauma finding in head injuries, where you have acute central diabetes insipidus. Best treatment for this is going to be giving them DDAVP. And you have a patient who's on torsamide, chlorthalidone, potassium bicarbonate citrate. His potassium usually runs a little bit low. This patient's been vomiting, is not able to take medication, blood pressure's low, dry mucous membrane, and we have all the findings here. Optimal fluid replacement would be A, sodium plus potassium bicarbonate and magnesium, B, potassium chloride and magnesium, C, potassium bicarbonate and magnesium, D, potassium chloride, saline and magnesium, or E, saline and magnesium. The correct answer is D, because you really have to make sure you're replacing this patient's alkalinity in alkalosis. When you have a low chloride, this causes the alkalosis to be perpetuated. These patients need chloride to help limit the damage of the metabolic alkalosis. Okay, this goes into all of it, and for time's sake, you can read it as well as I can. So, in the last case, patient is a diabetic. Cardiology wants to cast what's the most important factor to decrease the risk of contrast. A, N-acetylcysteine before and after, atorvastatin, normal saline before and after, sodium bicarbonate before and after, or stop metformin. The most important thing is E, stop the metformin.